Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. And today we talk about the management of myelofibrosis with Dr. Stephen Oh from the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on we'll show you the results of a survey of the faculty. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. And as we do in all of our webinars in the chat room, there's a brief, less than 1 minute survey to take, and we'd appreciate if you could do that. And at the end of the meeting, we'll also get a lot more out of this. We do webinars all the time. We have a year in review series going on that will continue next Tuesday, focusing on CLL and all the cool things that happen at ASH. Then we'll be continuing your review with gastroesophageal cancers. So much going on there, IOs, HER2-positive disease, et cetera. On February 13th, year in review lymphoma. We'll talk about the big Hodgkin study. February 15th, Thursday, management about biliary cancers. And now we're looking at maybe using IO-BEV, DERVA, actually, BEV, in patients who have just had TACE. And then we'll be talking about bladder cancer, a year in review, on February 22nd. So a lot going on in February. In March, we have our weekend meeting for general medical oncologists. We have 33 investigators coming to our hometown here in Miami, talking about a variety of cancers for the entire weekend. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Mesa on myelofibrosis, which is what we're going to be talking about today. And as we do in all of these, keep in mind the fact we will be talking of ad indication use of therapies, and that you really consult the package insert for more details about that. As we've been doing the last 3 years or so, we have a bunch of cases to present by mini videos with docs both from general practice and specialty. Here's where we're heading. We're going to do a quick update on the ASH meeting that just occurred. Then we'll go through the cases. Then we'll go through the survey, and hopefully we'll be able to take a bunch of your questions at that time. So ASH, Stephen, and I might say that the last couple of weeks has been pretty crazy for us because they decided to do ASCO GI and ASCO GU in the first couple of weeks of January. So we were going pretty wild and crazy, as I was telling you, Stephen. The last webinar we did, I closed by saying, have a great weekend, and then I realized it was only Tuesday. So I guess we'll be getting back to normal pretty soon. I guess you probably know that feeling getting out of ASH too, right, Stephen?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about ASH because, of course, you know, kind of was a big year for myelofibrosis in ASH. Two phase three studies, probably not practice changing, but let's just take a look at it because you don't see this too often. Palbociclib, what is that, Dr. O?
Yeah, so palbociclib is a BET inhibitor. The actual terminology, you know, is not necessarily that critical to understand, but really think of it as it is with a lot of these agents that are being examined in combination studies. A rationale for, you know, from the scientific standpoint of potential combinatorial or synergistic activity when paired with ruxolitinib or perhaps another JAK inhibitor, and could that provide additional benefit beyond ruxolitinib is capable of doing. So that's the way this study was designed, as well as the other big phase three study that was reported out at ASH. So palbociclib in combination with ruxolitinib versus ruxolitinib plus placebo, and that was the MANIFEST 3 study as shown here on these slides.
I guess one of the things about both of these studies, it looks like they saw, you know, some spleen reduction, but at least they couldn't pick up a difference in symptom improvement. Is that your take on what was seen here? This is looks like the waterfall plot's a little bit better for the combination.
Yeah, so the primary endpoint of both studies was spleen response. And as shown here, clearly the combination did result in a substantial improvement in spleen response here from the MANIFEST 2 study with palbociclib plus ruxolitinib. So you actually see more or less a doubling of the spleen response. So in my view, that is actually quite significant and meaningful clinically. We in the field, of course, have wrestled with that question of how much spleen response you really need. You know, if you have some degree of spleen response, is it really that important to have more, but I think the bottom line is clearly it was superior with the combination. In terms of symptoms in this study, not so clear whether there really was any improvement or additional benefit with the combination. You know, maybe a trend towards a little bit of improvement, in particular looking at absolute change in symptoms. But another way to look at this perhaps is to say that we know that Ruxolitinib provides substantial symptom benefit alone. So we can say from this study that combining pelabresib with Ruxolitinib, you maintain that split symptom response at the least, and maybe just a slight improvement. And add that to the substantial improvement in spleen response, and you have a combination strategy which is clearly providing clinical benefit.
And then I guess it didn't seem to add that much in terms of tolerability or toxicity issues compared to Ruxolitinib alone. What about this other study, the TRANSFORM-1 trial looking at navitoclax?
Yeah, so this here, navitoclax, the BCL-XL, BCL-2 inhibitor, and similar concept in terms of combination with Ruxolitinib, and can this provide additional benefit? And, very relatively similar results to manifest, too, in terms of clearly improved spleen response, as shown here, with the combination of navitoclax plus Ruxolitinib. A little bit of a distinction in terms of symptom response in that I don't think we'd even argue there was any trend towards symptom response, and maybe you could kind of guess that there might be a slight worsening of symptoms. So here you have again maybe no improvement in symptoms, but clearly a benefit in terms of spleen response. Maybe an important part of the equation here is in terms of tolerability. This is a drug that clearly causes on-target thrombocytopenia. And so we know that cytopenias can be limiting when we're delivering various treatments for patients with myelofibrosis. So if frequent dose adjustments or holding of the drug are necessary in light of that thrombocytopenia, it could be very difficult to administer this kind of combination strategy. So I would say that is a little bit of a distinction in terms of the two different studies. And if this were to be an approved option, I think it would be a little bit challenging to deliver this kind of treatment strategy.
So I'll let you all take a look at some of the reactions. This is from the survey we did in terms of the people's perception at this point in terms of these studies, in terms of efficacy and tolerability. But getting back to navitoclax, how does it differ from venetoclax, and has venetoclax been looked at?
Yeah, that's a great question. So venetoclax, of course, has activity in AML and MDS, but there seems to be some distinction in MPNs, including myelofibrosis. And it's thought that BCL-XL, in particular, as a target of navitoclax, may be a more relevant strategy in the case of MPNs. It gets a little confusing when you think in particular about advanced phase MPNs, accelerated or blast phase, and whether venetoclax perhaps could be more relevant there. There have been some small analyses of looking at venetoclax in that setting, for instance, in combination with hypomethylating agents. But in the case of myelofibrosis, navitoclax is thought to be, of the two, this the option that would seem to be the most relevant.
So a question from Joseph in the chat room. Is there any single agent activities to these two compounds? And also, can you envision right now a clinical situation where you'd like to use it, either one of these?
Great question. So I think there is a case for both agents, potentially as single agent options. Pelabresib in particular was studied in the earlier MANIFEST study, which is still ongoing with several different cohorts, including monotherapy treatment. And there seems to be activity there as well. And so you could certainly ask whether that might be either an additional option or maybe even a preferred setting to consider pelabresib as a treatment option. And in particular, I highlighted this on my survey responses, pelabresib does seem to have the capacity to improve anemia. So whether it's in combination with ruxolitinib or a single agent, this is also a unique aspect that has value as far as treatment for patients with myelofibrosis.
Do these agents work and people were progressing on ruxolitinib? And Hassan in the chat room wants to know, did these agents affect myelofibrosis?
Also great questions. So in general, these agents and other agents are, when they're studied as monotherapy, they're specifically examined in patients who have had either progression or intolerance to ruxolitinib or other JAK inhibitors. And so that is exactly the setting where I think there seems to be evidence of activity. So, right, you would potentially continue to use a JAK inhibitor such as ruxolitinib as initial treatment, and then one of these agents perhaps could be an option beyond that. And then the second question was about fibrosis, and there is data from with both of these agents with showing some degree of improvement in the bone marrow fibrosis. We have very much wrestled with this concept in the field in terms of what is the relevance or impact of changes in bone marrow fibrosis with any of these agents. We know from analyses that I've been involved with, and for instance, with ruxolitinib and momelotinib, two of the JAK inhibitors, that while there is certainly some percentage of patients who can be shown to have improvement of bone marrow fibrosis, what we found in that kind of that analysis where we actually looked at the Simplify 1 study from patients who were treated with either momelotinib or ruxolitinib, is that there was absolutely no correlation with any clinical outcome measure with respect to changes in bone marrow fibrosis. So in that sense, it would say, at least in that setting, that really it doesn't matter. It doesn't have any bearing. That said, with other agents, other mechanisms of action, I think it's still open territory as to whether bone marrow fibrosis changes or other aspects of bone marrow histology could perhaps be relevant.
So Venue in the chat room wants to know, what about using a combination in patients who progress on single agent ruxolitinib? In other words, I guess adding in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. So I think, just to broaden that out a little bit, I think that one of the, challenging aspects for treating physicians, if these drugs were to be approved, would it make sense to follow essentially how these studies were designed, which is upfront combination versus starting with, say, ruxolitinib first and then adding in the second agent, either sort of intentionally with a delayed start so you avoid overlapping toxicities in the beginning, or kind of like the question that was raised, do you actually just wait until the patient shows evidence of progression? And I think what I would expect to see if these agents would be approved is that you're going to see anything and everything in between. And there are, I think, good reasons or justification for that. Again, for instance, knowing or being able to establish what are the initial toxicities with any with either agent. For instance, with ruxolitinib, not necessarily frequent, but dose adjustment may be necessary in the first few months. So you can make an argument to say, let's get started with the ruxolitinib, let's get on a stable dose, and then add in the second agent.
I mentioned we just did ASCO GU, and I was just thinking about hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, where some people start with hormones, see how they do, and then they add in chemotherapy afterwards. Well, let's get to these case presentations. We've got some great cases here today. I'm going to start out with a pretty straightforward case of a patient who, like a lot of people over the last 10 or 12 years, that presents with myelofibrosis and has a good response to ruxolitinib. But the reason I present it is I reflect back. We know a lot of, I think 30% of our audience has been in oncology less than 10 years. So they may not know kind of what happened. It was around 2010 and 11 when the ruxolitinib COMFORT trials were presented. To me, that was one of the most amazing moments in the history of oncology, the stories we were hearing about people in these trials. And this first case is just a simple case of something we've been seeing a lot since then because of these trials. But I don't know. I just think that the human experience, or the experience as a physician, watching people so sick, even though, it's only maybe temporary, is really a profound experience. Anything you want to say about that? You've watched this. You've been part. This is a part of your daily life almost. To me, it's really incredible. Any thoughts?
Yeah. Honestly, I could not agree more with your perspective. Having, been in this field at, when ruxolitinib was first approved, and we saw, in particular in those earlier days, the patients who really just had the most severe symptoms, they had maybe had lost 30 pounds, extremely cachectic, severe pain related to splenomegaly, and with initiation of treatment with ruxolitinib, coming back a few months later and, just dramatic improvement and literally the words coming out of their mouths of this has been a miracle drug for me. So that is something that we experience. We continue to experience it today. But fortunately, we're not as frequently getting to these patients when they're at that severe of a stage. So again, a good thing is that we're getting to them earlier these days, but that is, it absolutely was a game changer. It is a game changer. And of course, we now have four approved JAK inhibitors. And, you know, some, depending on your perspective, you might say, well, these drugs don't put patients into remission. They don't cure the disease. So there's a limit in terms of their impact, but I think nonetheless, this class of treatment has revolutionized treatment for this disease.
I just can't imagine what the patient and family must think, you know, going in some of these situations. Anyhow, we're going to start out with a case like that from Dr. Mushtag, and then Dr. Palmer is going to be presenting a couple cases here and also focuses on myelofibrosis. Has some questions for you specifically, actually. Here's the case.
This is a 70-year-old, morbidly obese woman. She's a retired attorney. She was diagnosed with myelofibrosis. We put her on ruxolitinib, and I think within 6 or 8 weeks, she started feeling really good. I am not able to appreciate any more splenomegaly. Scans has improved more than 40%. And she's so impressed with the drug. And also at the same time, she's also very worried that she might progress anytime. She's tolerating the pill and she's not experiencing any cytopenias. Her lifestyle changed. Her fatigue improved a lot. She's more active. Her main concerns were persistent bloating sensation, abdominal distension, despite of not feeling hungry, and that has improved a lot. My question is, initially, most of the patients have thrombocytopenia, although not as bad as 50,000. The question is, how do you choose frontline therapy, especially what I have seen with ruxolitinib? There is initially a drop in platelet count, and that needs some dose adjustment. Should you continue ruxolitinib despite of thrombocytopenia with dose adjustment, or with just one time, if you have thrombocytopenia, just switch the therapy to next line of therapy?
Anything I should ask Dr. O about in the webinar we're doing with him?
If I were to think of questions for Stephen O, he's such a great scientist. He does a lot of the stuff in the lab to really understand a lot of these underpinnings. So I think getting his viewpoints on when you have a patient with anemia, like that patient we had with anemia and thrombocytopenia around 70, like to use momelotinib or pacritinib, because he actually presented a lot of that data looking at ACVR1 inhibition, which is the mechanism that helps improve anemia in pacritinib versus momelotinib.
So a lot of laboratory stuff, which not every investigator is involved with. And I'm really curious of some of your thoughts and you're thinking back how much, as you mentioned, now we have four approved JAK inhibitors, but we're learning they're not all the same. We pulled a couple of papers just to, first of all, alert the audience to the two papers and go ahead and read them. But also just kind of generally what you were looking at here. This one in particular, which looks at your laboratory work, looking at the difference between these agents. Rather than going through all the specific details, can you kind of just give us the whole gist of what you learned?
Yeah, sure. So I think the overarching question and reason why we did this study was the notion of, are all JAK inhibitors the same? Or are they different? I mean, we know that there's some distinctions based on the clinical experience, but we wanted to look more deeply at the mechanistic aspect of these drugs, what they're in relation to what their known targets are and what their downstream effects are. So the take-home point is that, yes, in many ways they are very similar, but clearly there are distinctions that we're able to identify based on the assays that we performed. And that includes cell line experiments, included looking at growth of colonies from patient cells. It included doing in vivo modeling and mouse models and things like that. And I'll just highlight some of the sort of the key distinctions. In particular, we showed in this paper that both momelotinib and pacritinib clearly do inhibit production of hepcidin via ACVR1. This is something that now, when we started the study, it was not really known, but now is recognized, I think, across our paper and some other analyses, that this is the case for both these drugs. They clearly have that activity. It's distinct from other JAK inhibitors such as ruxolitinib. And then the other thing is we found that in colony assays and in our in vivo experiments, that pacritinib seemed to be particularly efficacious in the doses that we examine. So again, a lot of similarities, a lot of overlap, but also some clearly distinct aspects of these different JAK inhibitors.
So this is another slide from your paper, and this, and just looking at this, you really start to get the idea what's how different these agents can be, and we just want to keep that in mind. Let me ask you, I guess we don't have head-to-head comparison of these secondary agents, but any thoughts about Dr. Mushtag's question about the situation of a patient starts out on Ruxolitinib but then becomes thrombocytopenic?
Yeah, no, it's a very important question, and I think for, you know, that we're all facing in practice with our patients, where as you described, you may have a patient has a nice response to Ruxolitinib initially that may be sustained for an extended period of time. But eventually the patient develops a more progressive thrombocytopenia. And the question is, do you switch to another agent? Do you dose adjust the ruxolitinib? If you're going to switch, are you going to consider, for instance, momelotinib or pacritinib if the platelets are becoming particularly lower? And I want to emphasize that, you know, this is not necessarily a clearly the one right answer is the best kind of thing. There are arguments that can be made depending on the specific circumstances as far as different options that could be considered. So for instance, let's say the platelets are dropping to around 100,000. Could you continue the ruxolitinib? Could you optimize the dose so that the patient is able to maintain the optimal symptom benefit? Quite possibly, yes. Should you consider switching because of the notion that the ruxolitinib is essentially being underdosed at that point, and could you achieve more superior symptom benefit by switching? Yes, quite possibly. And then the question is, are you going to switch to momelotinib or pacritinib? And, you know, as you know, the way I look at it is you have to consider all of the different features. So it's not just the platelet count, it's the hemoglobin. You know, what extent of anemia is there? To what extent are the spleen and symptoms problematic? So there are different choices. So just to kind of break it down on a very sort of practical standpoint, in particular, those patients who develop very severe thrombocytopenia, platelets less than 50, that's where I think the strongest argument for pacritinib is currently. If you're in that 50 to 100,000 range, I think you can, you know, make a case for either of those agents. And again, it may have in some respect to do with the degree of anemia. Now, we clearly demonstrate, as I mentioned, both from our laboratory studies and from clinical analyses, that both momelotinib and pacritinib have the capacity to inhibit hepcidin production and improve anemia. So again, it's not a black or white situation, but the whole picture of the different features are how you might make that choice.
So can you comment a little bit more about ACVR1? I mean, you hear all kinds of markers over the years, but I haven't heard of this one lately. What exactly it is and what the implications are?
Yeah, so first of all, I think it can be confusing because ACVR1 is often also referred to as ALK2. This is the same molecule, but this is known to be the primary regulator of hepcidin production. And as demonstrated with this diagram, it is through the hepatocytes that hepcidin is produced. And it was kind of, you know, like a lot of things in science and medicine, discovered by accident that momelotinib actually hits ACVR1 and therefore reduces hepcidin. That then translates to its anemia benefit. And then in turn, that pacritinib also has this activity. So that is quite clear that both of those drugs have that activity and that it probably is an important component of the anemia benefit. And I put that qualifier in probably because there are some other aspects of this that could make it a little bit more complicated, which includes that we know that production of hepcidin is also regulated through signaling via JAK2 downstream of IL-6. And so these inhibitors that target ACVR1 in addition to either JAK1 and or JAK2, there could be some component of that that relates to its impact on hepcidin. And then finally, not to overcomplicate this, but we know that hitting JAK2 itself is a detrimental in terms of erythropoiesis, so production of red blood cells. So I guess the take-home point is there's probably some balance of targeting JAK1N or JAK2 that's beneficial, and there's some maybe threshold where it can be detrimental, at least in terms of anemia. And then you bring in the hepcidin part of the equation with ACVR1, and again, maybe that there's some sort of optimal balance of hitting these different targets in terms of what can be achieved clinically.
I was just flashing again back on the comfort days. And I remember, you know, looking at this biology, I remember there we had a challenge because initially everybody, not everybody, but there were a lot of people who thought that ruxolitinib would only work in people with JAK mutations. But so we had a big education challenge. I think it was met. And now we're into another a whole layer of things to learn. One other issue, again, that's been talked about, ever since these agents came out, is it really modifying the disease, or the benefit that you see, is it all related to symptom improvement, performance status, et cetera? And you've done work in this area. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is also something that, you know, from this paper that we published and other, you know, discussions that my colleagues and I will have frequently, we debate and you know, sort of acknowledge the murkiness of this to some extent, meaning that, you know, I think if you were to say the bottom line is disease modification is a change in overall survival. Well, I think we can all agree and accept that. That's true. But there are all kinds of other aspects of clinical features and disease response to some of these agents that maybe we could make an argument also reflect some degree of disease modification. So, for instance, I think the most, you know, relevant point in that regard is anemia improvement an indication of disease modification. You know, you might say, well, it's sort of palliative in a certain sense, but we know that anemia is one of the strongest negative risk factors in patients with myelofibrosis. And we also know from some of these studies and some of these agents that achievement of anemia response does also relate to extension of survival. So in that sense, you could say if you can improve anemia and those patients who respond have a superior overall survival, that is disease modification. I think that's a pretty compelling argument. So we're struggling a little bit, and we have struggled in the field with really agreeing on a consensus of what we can call disease modification. But I think the bottom line is that we're clearly making headway with some of these agents in terms of improving not just symptoms, but other features of this disease that have a meaningful impact on the quality of life and outcome for these patients.
Let's try a little word association thing for the next case. What is the first thing that comes to your mind when I say the words myelofibrosis, anemia, and Jehovah's Witness? Anyhow, this is a 69-year-old patient of Dr. Battinger. She's in the community, but she was on the Ohio State faculty for a while, and she, in the community, specializes in hematologic cancer. She's presented a lot of cases for us. Again, 69-year-old lady with a bunch of other problems, including NASH, cirrhosis of the liver, who's a Jehovah's Witness and will be refusing blood products. Here's the case.
It's a very challenging situation, and she's also a pretty fresh diagnosis, and she's really relatively young. So she's 69, and she does have non-alcoholic cirrhosis, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and type 2 diabetes. She is planned to start an ESA, but my only other questions were whether there are any other suggestions regarding management of this patient, and at what point would you consider changing her treatment? At what point do you consider the momelotinib to be a treatment failure in light of her current blood counts, and what would be your next recommended treatment option? This is a tricky case because all of the JAK inhibitors contribute to cytopenias. Pacritinib holds a label for patients who have thrombocytopenia. So patients with platelet counts under 50,000 were largely ineligible to participate in the JAK inhibitor trials. And so pacritinib, I think, might be a nice choice. Her platelet count is not that bad, but I think it might be a reasonable choice if it continues to decline. For her, hopefully the ESA in addition to the momelotinib would help. I do have another patient who also had pretty significant anemia and responded really well to ruxolitinib and luspatercept. And that might be another possibility for this particular patient. So I would keep that in my back pocket as well.
So this lady also, again, you have to keep in mind, has a little bit of cirrhosis, not too bad liver function right now. I assumed everybody thought of momelotinib when I said that, but that is what she was treated with. She initially did have some benefit, but now her hemoglobin is starting to drift down. And as you heard, what her thoughts are. Any comments or thoughts about the case?
Yeah, well, I mean, you asked what word came to mind, and it's the same first word that she said, which is challenging. So this case is very challenging, there's no doubt. And especially knowing that the patient's already been treated with momelotinib, and if anything, the count seemed to be getting worse most recently. So that's a very tough situation, given the patient is a Jehovah's Witness. And I would just say my approach would be similar to what she outlined, is thinking creatively about all possibilities. So meaning that adding an ESA, yes, absolutely, that's I think worth considering. She mentioned ruxolitinib plus luspatercept in another patient. That is another potential strategy that could be considered. And then, again, mixing and matching things that, honestly, of course, are not specifically supported by any particular available data, but thinking of agents that might have activity against anemia. So danazol. So the MOMENTUM study looked at actually momelotinib versus danazol. But could you combine danazol with either momelotinib or another JAK inhibitor? So I think, you have to get creative here because you have very few options otherwise.
We were talking earlier about these new agents. I still can't pronounce palabresib, but navitoclax. If you could access that, would that be a consideration?
Well, absolutely. So palabresib, as I mentioned, it does clearly have some capacity to improve anemia. So here is where, again, if palabresib were available, would you consider switching to that as monotherapy? Would you actually consider adding it to momelotinib, again, without no specific data? Of course, because the available data is either alone or with combination with ruxolitinib. But these are, I think, practical questions that we'll be facing if these drugs do become available. And there's some data for navitoclax in terms of anemia benefit as well. So I think, again, for in this kind of situation, you would be exploring all those potential options.
So it's pretty interesting when you sit down with a general medical oncologist and hear about their cases. Dr. Morgenstein's presented in probably every kind of tumor you can imagine to us. And he's in a community-based setting. He saw this patient who was a 75-year-old lady, and he didn't get too much information on her prior therapy when she showed up in his clinic. But amazingly, she was on a trial of pactinib for 4 years, which is pretty interesting. But when he saw her, she had gone past that and now had significant disease progression, particularly splenomegaly. It really also brings up the issue of palliative issues that come up in management of this disease. Here's Dr. Morgenstein.
She presented many years ago with cytopenias and splenomegaly. When I met her, she had, as many of these patients do, massive splenomegaly. I mean, this woman, if she was 5 foot tall, that would be a lot, and her spleen was probably 2 feet. So it was quite symptomatic. Her platelet count basically ran between 20 and 30,000. So my question in her is, what's the role for surgery, which I don't think we're using anymore, radiation therapy to palliate massive splenomegaly? What's the best way to assess whether these JAK2 inhibitors are working as far as measuring spleen size or symptom management questionnaires?
Any thoughts?
Yes. So again, another challenging case, and a patient like this with severe splenomegaly, Dr. Morgenstein mentioned that maybe we're not really doing splenectomies these days. I would say we're doing it certainly less, or we're recommending it less and not particularly very frequently. But in certain cases where we've exhausted one or more JAK inhibitors and the patient has a severe splenomegaly, I do recommend it at least as an option to consider for certain patients. This patient being 75 and is not necessarily 100% going to exclude that possibility, but more likely would be a younger patient who, in terms of risk-benefit considerations, would be more likely to be a potential candidate for splenectomy. If surgery is not an option, splenic irradiation could be considered, embolization procedure could be considered. I will say that my limited experience with embolization has been that the initial post-procedure period can be quite difficult in terms of pain control. But surgery is not an option. These are other possible avenues that could be explored. Otherwise, you've got a very, very tough situation here. This patient has very severe thrombocytopenia, has already been treated with pacritinib. Let's acknowledge and appreciate that the response to pacritinib, as outlined, was quite outstanding and sustained. So that's really good. But now we're at a very difficult spot in this patient. So there are very few options in this particular situation.
So when I was looking at your CV, I saw this paper. It kind of reminds me of this case. I guess this is a patient who got pirtobrutinib for 4 years. Looks like the counts did pretty well. What happened with this patient?
Yeah, so this was a patient who's being cared for by Dr. Yacoub. And clearly an outstanding, exceptional response to pirtobrutinib that was sustained, has been sustained for quite some period of time. And I think it really illustrates that though, you know, this is not the typical response to pirtobrutinib, there are definitely going to be these potential for these exceptional responders, and it reinforces that this disease is heterogeneous. So every patient's different. Yes, they can be have the common mutations such as JAK2 or CALR, but they're clearly different phenotypes within the disease, and the potential for these kind of unique responses is there.
So let's go to another case. This is a patient of Dr. Palmer, a 57-year-old woman with symptomatic primary MF.
57-year-old female. She presents to her internist with fatigue, night sweats, and weight loss. On physical exam, her spleen was palpable at 10 centimeters below the left costal margin at the midclavicular line. She has no significant past medical history. Her bone marrow biopsy showed increased fibrosis with MF 2 to 3 out of 3. She had diploid cytogenetics. Her next generation sequencing showed a JAK2 mutation as well as DNMT3A mutation. She had no increase in blasts in her marrow, and her peripheral blasts were around 1% or less. So how would you approach risk assessment in this patient? In this patient, would you use something like the DIPS or the DIPS Plus? How about using something like the MIPS? And would there be anything about her case that would give you a sense of how you think she would respond to ruxolitinib? So initiation of therapy, how would you decide upon that? Would this be something based on symptoms, based on cytopenias? Would it be based on mutation profile? In her case, I would likely start her on a drug like ruxolitinib purely based on her symptoms. She's having night sweats. She's uncomfortable. I think she certainly could get a benefit from that.
Any comments?
Yes. So the first part in terms of prognostication, you know, in a patient like this, if you have all the available data, which I think you do, then my preferred risk stratification scheme is the MIP70 version, you know, 2.0. And so that allows you to incorporate all of the important data, including molecular data, next generation sequencing data, et cetera. So that's what I would use in this particular patient. But as I think we all can agree, these prognostication schemes generally are used for informational purposes in terms of understanding the long-term prognosis. The main distinction with regard to treatment decision-making with these prognostication schemes at this time is really mostly to do with is the patient really a compelling candidate for transplantation? Now, this is a young enough patient for sure that could be on the table, but not necessarily something you would pursue right away. So initiation of medical treatment, such as with a JAK inhibitor, such as ruxolitinib, would certainly be a very appropriate strategy. And then within that part, in terms of which JAK inhibitor would you use, I would, you know, agree with Dr. Palmer in terms of focusing on the initial treatment in part on the degree of symptoms, also factoring in cytopenias. And we know that with the approval of momelotinib, both ruxolitinib and momelotinib can be used according to the label, and fedratinib too, for first-line treatment. And the distinction with regard to momelotinib in particular is for patients with anemia. Now, we know that almost every patient with myelofibrosis has some degree of anemia diagnosis. So that does leave quite a bit of overlap, at least as far as the label indication is concerned. But more practically speaking, in this particular case, if the symptoms are very prominent and the patient is not severely cytopenic, I think ruxolitinib continues to be a very, very good choice for first-line treatment.
Could you comment a little bit more, like more in a granular sense, about how you look at the prognostic score and factor it into this idea of when or if you're going to do a transplant in a younger patient?
Yeah, so I think, you know, generally speaking, whether you use the MIP70 or use DIPS or any of these other calculators, if patients in the higher risk categories that's where you say, okay, I'm really concerned about the long-term outcome. We know that these available treatments such as ruxolitinib and the other JAK inhibitors clearly can provide benefit, but in the longer term, they're not going to alter the disease trajectory in the way that we would hope for these younger, higher risk patients. So my approach to that would be to say, because I'm not a transplanter myself, let's have you see our transplant specialist. Let's have that initial consultation. Let's gather information so you can understand what are the risks, what are the potential benefits of transplantation. But still, generally speaking, we would not necessarily push to proceed a transplant at initial diagnosis. For sure, when a patient is showing signs of progression to accelerated blast phase, I think that's kind of a slam dunk in a certain sense. But there still is a little bit of gray area in terms of should you move forward with transplant in a high-risk myelofibrosis patient in the absence of any signs of progression to accelerated blast phase. I think, Dr. Palmer is a transplanter herself, so she has certainly a lot of expertise in that regard. But I think, again, it's a case-by-case kind of situation. And I think in general, we would be starting with something like ruxolitinib or another JAK inhibitor at least prior to moving forward with transplant.
So 57-year-old woman is now 60. Here's Dr. Palmer.
So if we fast forward this case, the patient was started on ruxolitinib 20 milligrams twice daily. She had an excellent response with complete resolution of her splenomegaly and symptoms. She initially had a mild anemia, but that didn't require transfusions. And ultimately, after a few months, had a balancing out of her anemia, and she was about at a hemoglobin of 11 where she was previously. After 3 years, she is now older and noticed a return of night sweats as well as increase in her spleen size. Her CBC shows a hemoglobin of 11.5, platelets of 200, white blood cell count of 23.5, and her differential is significant for having 4% blasts. Her bone marrow biopsy showed that she had 3 out of 3 fibrosis. She had a hypocellular marrow, no increase in blasts. Again, she had normal cytogenetics. Her next generation sequencing showed a JAK2 V617F mutation, DNMT3A mutation, IDH2 mutation, TET2 mutation, and her spleen was palpable at 18 centimeters below the left costal margin. How would you approach this patient? Would you switch JAK inhibitors? Would you try to increase her ruxolitinib to a higher dose? If you were to switch JAK inhibitors, would you choose something like fedratinib? Would you think of pacritinib or momelotinib? How about hydroxyurea? Is there anything that you would do with regards to managing her spleen? She definitely has shown that she has progressed through ruxolitinib. In this patient, I personally would likely choose fedratinib, and that's primarily because of the fact that she still has very good blood counts, and fedratinib can be successful in 35% of the patients who have failed ruxolitinib.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, so this is exactly the kind of scenario where I think fedratinib does make sense as a second-line option after ruxolitinib. The patient is, as Dr. Palmer outlined, clearly progressing on ruxolitinib, having worsening of symptoms, worsening of splenomegaly. But the important distinction with regard to what to do is that the counts remain relatively preserved. And that is the setting in particular where I would consider fedratinib as a potentially appropriate next line of treatment. I think that is less common than the more typical scenario where the patient is developing progressive cytopenias, and there would be more of a consideration for either momelotinib or pacritinib. But here, where the spleen is very large, counts are still relatively preserved, I think that's where, again, the fedratinib does make sense.
Anything you want to say about using fedratinib, the thymine issue, and also tolerability issues that come up with the drug?
Certainly, it's an important consideration. So the thymine, while there were relatively rare cases of suspected or possible Wernicke's encephalopathy, I think we probably all agree that just checking a thymine level and taking thymine supplementation to be safe is an advisable strategy. So I would do that for sure in any patient who is going to be treated with fedratinib. Now the other part was, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on that.
Tolerability issues.
Yes, tolerability, right. So we know for sure that fedratinib does come with some GI toxicity. And so that's to be expected. And it is related to targeting a FLT3. We know that's similar to some extent with pacritinib as well. So in both of those cases, I would recommend patients take antiemetics, scheduled antiemetics initially, and be advised to have antidiarrheals on hand in case they need them. And what I think happens in many cases is the antiemetics are helpful initially, and then eventually they can be peeled off. And the diarrhea is a matter of counseling. Certainly it would be ideal if that were not the case, but counseling the patient to be aware that this could be somewhat of a problem, have antidiarrheals available, and then generally speaking, it's manageable for most patients.
So a case from Dr. Kumar in the chat room. Dr. Kumar is a part of the Florida Cancer Specialist. That weekend program we're about to do, we're doing in partnership with them. He has a 60-year-old man who's referred for anemia. On workup, is found to have primary myelofibrosis, but his risk score is zero on IPSS. He's totally asymptomatic. And I guess, you know, it's kind of relating back to what you were saying before about how you think through the younger patient, but now you have a younger patient who's very low risk. What would you say to that patient?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, in a different way, and to contrast with some of the other cases, also, honestly, a bit of a challenging situation. So on the one hand, you would say if you're, you know, very low risk and you have no symptoms, there's really nothing to do in terms of initiating treatment, given that most of the treatments we think of as being particularly effective for symptoms, if you have no symptoms, then, you know, no treatment is necessary or indicated. Also considering that, you know, there is the possibility with many of these treatments that you're going to lower the count. So why do that in a patient who is essentially asymptomatic? So I think that's the justification or the argument to say, watch and wait, you know, nothing to do at the moment. We're, of course, on the flip side, concerned about the long-term outcome, even for these you know, lower-risk patients, that their overall survival is going to be impacted in the longer term. But at the bottom line is, in that regard, at the moment, there's not a compelling justification for any particular treatment to modify that longer-term outcome in a substantial way. So in a case like that, in general, I would sit tight. The only thing I would say is that, in my view, we often underappreciate symptoms. So I often hear, okay, from another provider or a colleague, this, you know, such and such patient really is asymptomatic. And then if I were to evaluate the patient, my conclusion would be a little bit different, is that they actually do have symptoms. It's just that we haven't really appreciated or asked the right questions, or they've become accommodated, or they're, you know, they're stoic and things like that. So I think, in my view, we often underappreciate symptoms.
It brings up another thing I've thought about, which is in, you know, the general oncology setting where, you know, you don't see myelofibrosis all day long the way you do, you know, in terms of these symptom scores and whether they're worth doing and how to look at them, that are these scales specific to a myelofibrosis. Any thoughts about that? Is there any kind of, you know, electronic app or something that's easy to use for that?
Yeah, so I very firmly believe that the symptom assessment forms are incredibly useful. We have as I think you know, in embedded these in virtually every clinical trial for myelofibrosis for many years now. So there with the studies at least, there are often electronic devices for the patients to document their symptoms, and that's really great. Now, that, of course, that's in the context of clinical trials. What we've done in our practice is we just have a paper form that patients fill out at every visit, and it's not the most like elegant system, but what I found in my experience is that it's particularly useful for the longitudinal assessment, because we know that obviously these are subjective patient-reported symptom assessments, and so to one patient maybe a symptom score of 30, maybe to another patient a symptom score of 50. But you really, if you track it longitudinally over time, you can really understand, is it changing? Is it getting worse? How is it responding to some particular treatment?
So I want to show a little bit of the survey that we did of the investigator. We showed you a couple things earlier. And we asked a number of questions about sort of management of patients who are receiving one of these JAK inhibitors, and, you know, just to get a little bit of granularity about how investigators approach this. here we asked in terms of pacritinib, and they bring up GI issues, it seems, mainly. I think you mentioned that previously. What about QTC intervals? How much of an issue is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's generally recommended to get at least a baseline EKG with pacritinib, and we will do that. But I think it's a relatively minor issue. So, you know, it is the case with a lot of the TKIs, but, for the most part, I don't view it as a big issue.
What about momelotinib? Again, in terms of tolerability, seems like people talk about GI, although you say not much of a problem.
So, you know, there is a little bit of GI toxicity with momelotinib, but I think it is certainly less so than with pacritinib or fedratinib. So, yes, there is a little bit of it, but not to that level, and that's why I didn't really call that out.
So I want to go back to the cases, and Dr. Battinger has an interesting case of a woman who was on ruxolitinib. Somehow she got down to a dose of 5 milligrams a day, which I'm not even sure is therapeutic, but she developed congestive heart failure on ruxolitinib. And anyhow, here's a story from Dr. Battinger.
69-year-old woman. She'd kind of been to several different healthcare systems before she landed in West Virginia during the pandemic. She stayed on ruxolitinib 5 milligrams daily once a day, a little bit less than a year. And she presented with new onset congestive heart failure and a decline in her ejection fraction to 20%. She underwent an MRI of her heart as well as a cardiac catheterization. There was no occlusive coronary disease. And around that time, the thought was being tossed around that ruxolitinib caused her heart failure. And so it was discontinued. This past fall, she had 19% circulating blasts, worrisome for AML transformation.
Any thoughts about this? I guess you were saying, has it even been reported? I'm not sure. Heart
certainly is, yeah, it is certainly not an association that is, you know, frequently been reported. There could be some isolated case reports, but it's not something I would think of as being a known complication or association with ruxolitinib. And in this particular case, where you had the patient only taking 5 milligrams once daily, of course, it's a very low dose. So although it doesn't sound like they had any obvious alternative etiology for the heart failure, I'm not necessarily sure that that was really driving the development of that. But clearly another challenging case, difficult situation, patient progressing to AML, regardless of the heart failure. So a tough situation, period.
All right. And one more case here from Dr. Palmer, a 69-year-old woman who's been on ruxolitinib for a while and now developing progression. Here's Dr. Palmer.
This is a 69-year-old female, past medical history of primary myelofibrosis. She was diagnosed with this 3 years ago when she was found to have splenomegaly with a spleen that was 10 centimeters below the left costal margin. She had anemia with a hemoglobin of 8, leukocytosis with a white blood cell count of 22 and no increase in blasts. She had night sweats, weight loss, and significant fatigue at diagnosis. She was started on ruxolitinib at 10 milligrams twice daily, had a fantastic response. Her spleen had improved quite a bit. And even though it wasn't completely resolved, it was about 3 centimeters below the left costal margin, she actually felt quite a bit better. She still had a lot of fatigue, but the night sweats had gone away and her weight started to go up. 3 years on being on ruxolitinib and fairly well controlled, she started to develop increasing anemia and splenomegaly. The ruxolitinib had to be dose reduced and ultimately was discontinued. What is the clinical implication of ruxolitinib failure? And how accurate is the data that we have? What are ways that we can try to prolong that ruxolitinib response? And is it things like adding drugs? Should the approach be waiting till somebody fails ruxolitinib and adding a drug, seeing if they have a suboptimal response and adding the drug, or just using two drugs of doublet therapy up front? If the latter is chosen, how would you choose the patients to do that for?
These are different questions than you get from your fellows on rounds, right?
Absolutely.
Any thoughts?
So thanks to Dr. Palmer for posing the difficult questions. I think these are really important questions that we're pondering in a good way, maybe. going to be more, even more so, struggling with. Let's just assume that we, whether it's pelabresib or other agents, that we are going to have additional approved agents in the near future, and then we have to ask, kind of, I'll tackle that latter part first, of which patients or when would we consider combination therapy? And you know, you ask that, if you think about that in terms of you take a patient who is at initial diagnosis with some degree of splenomegaly symptoms and whatnot, and you say, I should be sort of quote-unquote aggressive with combination therapy up front. Should I start with ruxolitinib only and then, you know, either soon thereafter or only at signs of progression, consider adding a combination agent? And that those are tough questions. And in some respect, you would say, yeah, reserve the combination treatment for those really aggressive patients with severe features at diagnosis. But you could also conversely argue that patients who are not as advanced, who have more robust counts at diagnosis, are the ones who are going to sort of tolerate combination therapy up front. And those are the ones who are actually going to think about that longer term benefit. So I think, you know, it's hard to say one strategy is really the right choice for any particular patient. But these are, again, sort of tough questions we're going to be increasingly struggling with.
I'm starting to hear the use of terms, maybe they've been out there a long time and I just started hearing it, but of, like, I think it's called cytopenic MF versus proliferative MF. And I guess this would be proliferative MF. And also the idea that maybe the cytopenic is primary MF and the proliferative might be MPN turning into MF. Any thoughts about those terminologies? Is that the way you view it?
It is, for the most part, how I think, and most of us view it, and it's something that's evolved in particular over the last several years, this understanding that these are categories that are by no means completely distinct. There's a lot of overlap, so they're not, you know, entirely discrete buckets, but we can see that there are these broadly defined subgroups of patients. The cytopenic patients, as you mentioned, are more likely to be primary myelofibrosis, lower counts to begin with diagnosis, also less likely to be JAK2 mutant, which tends to be more associated with that more proliferative phenotype. So that category, the proliferative category, more likely to have an antecedent history of polycythemia vera or a central thrombocythemia and to have those higher counts. So there, it clearly is some distinction, but again, not entirely discrete buckets.
So another thing, actually, Dr. Palmer mentioned for her last patient was that she was gaining weight. And I wasn't aware, actually, but you were saying this is well known, but I hadn't heard it, that ruxolitinib often leads to weight gain. And I looked up a paper and it may be metabolic in or you know, why it happens. So any comments on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is absolutely expected that ruxolitinib is going to cause weight gain. And it is thought that it's through alteration of metabolic pathways. And we, you know, to give it some historical context, it is in the initial days with ruxolitinib became available was very desirable because we had these patients, again, who had come in having lost 30 pounds. So we say, great, you're able to put on weight. But increasingly over time, in some patients, just more and more weight gain becomes problematic. And then also over time, as we began to treat more patients who didn't necessarily have that severe of a presentation, it actually becomes problematic. So obviously, if you're already obese to begin with, that weight gain is not desirable, and it actually is problematic in terms of the patient's overall health. So we have increasingly seen this as a, you know, again, unappealing aspect in many respects of ruxolitinib, and it does seem to be distinct that the other JAK inhibitors at least aren't as likely to cause that much of a problem with weight gain.
Interesting. Okay, one more thing from the survey. 75-year-old woman gets ruxolitinib, 15 BID for 2 years, has a good response. Now worsening cytopenias, new onset splenomegaly, more symptoms, platelets 76,000, hemoglobin 6.7. Everybody says switch to momelotinib. What I want to know is suppose the platelet count was 35,000 with the hemoglobin 6.7.
No, exactly. So even in with these specific numbers, although all three of us agreed with momelotinib as being the preferred option, you can absolutely make a case for pacritinib in this situation. But I think that the more clear distinction, as you described it, is if the platelets are even lower. So if they're 35,000, then I think the sort of the balance swings even more so towards pacενib.
So, Stephen, thank you so much. We all learned so much today. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back next Tuesday, and we'll continue our year in review series talking about chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Finally, pirtobrutinib got approved in CLL after having previously been available for mantle cell. So I'm really curious to see how that's playing out, as well as all the other things that happen with CLL. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Stephen.
My pleasure.